Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan, and today we're going to talk about the Jefferson versus Hamilton feud of 1790 to 1793. Now, those dates are important because these are the years in which Jefferson was actually in the cabinet with Alexander Hamilton, and the two sides would go at it quite fiercely. So that's why the title of the presentation is At Swords Point, and you know, Dr. Gutzman thankfully came up with that, so I'll give him credit for that, but these two forces, the Jefferson-Hamilton feud, is going to affect the way in which the government will operate, the way people think about the government, the way we think about the Constitution, from this point forward. And so really what you have here in this first cabinet is the beginning of what we often call the first party system in America, the Democratic Republicans against the Federalists. But there's much more here, and it not only is at the federal level, but also at the state level, that you're seeing some reaction to some of Alexander Hamilton's plans. This is where Hamilton finally exposes himself as a liar. Now, he was lying in 1788 when he said the Constitution could not do X, Y, and Z because it doesn't say we can do it. So when he gets in the Treasury Department, he starts doing X, Y, and Z, and so he's called on that. And this is why, you know, this period of time is so important. And of course, we focus a lot of attention on the Supreme Court, and John Marshall's doing his own thing later on by, you know, the early 1800s, 1801. You know, Hamilton sets the stage for that. And so Alexander Hamilton is really the reason why we have this much abused, much maligned Constitution. And so let's look at the issues here. And what I'm going to do is actually break this down by year. I'm going to start with 1790. We'll look at some of the issues of 1790, also 1791. 1792 and 1793. So some really important stuff going on here, and let's go ahead and get started. Now, Washington, of course, George Washington, first president of the United States under the Constitution, decides he's going to have what historians often call an all-star cabinet. He's going to pick the best and brightest. He's going to pick Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State. Of course, Washington himself thought that he was the Secretary of State. So Jefferson was going to kind of be his do boy, you know, his gopher. He was just going to do whatever Washington really wanted him to do. Washington understood that he had a firm grasp on that. Also, the Secretary of War, Henry Knox, was kind of in the same position. Washington thought he was the guy that was going to control those two departments. So these people weren't really going to have much power. But Washington didn't know a whole lot about finances. And so he's going to really rely on Alexander Hamilton quite a bit for that particular area. So this is a problem. Washington's a great individual, and in fact, I call him the most important man and the greatest man in American history. And he really was the glue that held the entire cabinet together and the entire government together in the first years under the Constitution. But perhaps by 1794, he's gravitating too much towards Hamilton, and of course, Jefferson's out of the cabinet by that point, so Hamilton really has Washington's ear, and that does cause some problems. Washington does some things as president that are, looking back on them, are unconstitutional, and he was grabbing too much power, even though in his first term, you really couldn't say that as much about Washington. There's one particular issue I think that there's some problems with, but Washington was pretty careful to implement executive powers in a way that future presidents should have followed so they wouldn't abuse the executive authority. One thing you can say about the Constitution itself, though, and the executive branch, when you look at the early proposals for the executive branch, perhaps the Founding Fathers weren't, you know, far-sighted enough. They didn't see beyond George Washington. You know, Benjamin Franklin did. He said, well, look, we all trust George Washington. Yeah, absolutely. Everybody in America trusts George Washington. Great. What happens after George Washington? What are we going to get then? You know, we're going to get Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson and, you know, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. This is what we're going to get. I mean, who wants these people? Right? I mean, you know, these people are power-hungry megalomaniacs. Who wants these people at all? You know, Franklin Roosevelt and Teddy Roosevelt. That's what we're going to get. Abraham Lincoln. I mean, these are the people that we have to be afraid of. You know, John Adams. We're going to get John Adams after George Washington. My gosh, what the heck is going to happen? So, you know, Benjamin Franklin thought John Adams was insane. So he was perceptive that the executive branch had caused problems. And the cabinet within the executive branch is here, you know, in so many ways, the root of all evil, because you have these guys in the cabinet, Hamilton most importantly, who are causing all kinds of just running, you know, mayhem. This is mayhem, general mayhem that they're creating and just running roughshod over the Constitution. Forget about that document. Who cares? So Hamilton, As he wanted early in the Philadelphia Convention, when he didn't get his way, he just picked up his toys and went home. Hamilton now was going to push for that national government. He always wanted. He wanted this national government. Let's have it. And we're going to put this thing in effect, and I'm going to do everything I can to get it through the Treasury Department. So the question is here in the early phases, and of course Dr. Gusman talks about the first Congress, but you know, what kind of government and constitution is the United States going to have? Are we going to have a national government or a federal government? You swore up and down, Hamilton and Wilson and Ellsworth and all these individuals out there, we're only going to have a federal government. It's just going to be the same as the Articles, except we're going to have a little more power. Right? Swearing up and down, this is the way it's going to be. Don't worry about it. Trust us. Trust us, good citizens. Oops. When we get it, well, we want a national government. Forget about that federal government. So we're going to have a constitution as ratified or a malleable constitution suited to the needs of the government. And that's kind of what Hamilton's looking at here. Well, yeah, I see an Article 1, Section 8. I can't do that, but, you know, I need it. So we're going to have it. So that's what we're going to get. So in 1790, he issues something called the First Report on the Public Credit. Now, everyone understood that when the Constitution was ratified, that they would probably assume all the debt of the old central authority, because, of course, it's the new central authority, so they're going to get it. So there was going to be assumption of the foreign and the domestic debt the United States incurred under the Articles of Confederation. That was not a problem. And, of course, Hamilton famously said, you know, a little debt's not bad. A little debt, we get a line of credit, we establish credit. This will allow us to borrow money, allow people to have confidence in the federal government. If we don't have a line of credit, we're kind of stuck in the water. You know, we can't always be spending out of our pocket. You know, we have to have some debt, right? Now, you question whether you really need that or not. States operate at times, or at least it did, without a whole lot of debt. Now, of course, they have it, but they have to keep their budgets balanced. The United States government doesn't have to do that. So debt can be a little problem. In fact, Thomas Jefferson said, borrowing money is a bad thing. Of course, all the Jeffersonians thought that. Of course, the Articles of Confederation, they could borrow there too. So, we always had that power. But the problem with this First Report on the Public Credit was that Hamilton wanted to not only assume the debt of the central government, he wanted to assume the debt of the state governments. Hamilton said, we need to do this. Because this will foster a national identity. So what he's going to do is make the states dependent on the federal government. And this is exactly what the states feared. Now, Hamilton was doing a lot of things here ingeniously to get not only the states slopping at the federal trough by assuming the debt, but also individuals. He had all these old Revolutionary War veterans out there, guys that were out of job. The economy kind of stinks in 1789. So he says, let's put these people on the payroll. You get them on the payroll, they're going to be dependent on the federal government, they're going to vote for us. So let's do that. Sound familiar? In fact, John Randolph of Roanoke had one of the best lines ever in a speech in railing against a standing army. Now, we all know people that go out and volunteer to serve in the military and do their duty, that's what they see they're doing. They want to be compensated for that. We don't have a problem with that, compensating for it. But Randolph had a little different take on that. He said, look, essentially what you have here in a standing army, you have a bunch of welfare cases. These people are out there just sucking off the system. And yeah, okay, they're fighting for the country, all right. But, they're sucking off the system. They're just welfare. That was Randolph's position. He was completely against it, and so were a lot of the other founding fathers against the standing army. That's what you had the militia for, and they didn't cost anything. You had militia rallies, and you had to have arms and things set aside for them, but they had jobs, right? I mean, they had farms. They were, working somewhere. They weren't just being paid by the government to sit around and drill all day. There was that argument. I think it's a fairly valid argument at times. Okay, so Hamilton says this is going to forge a national identity. And we need to do this to push everyone into this centralization. Well, Virginia sees right through it. Now, the other issue here, of course, was that many of the states had already paid off their debt. Virginia had already paid off its debt. Its War for Independence debt. They didn't have a debt anymore. But Massachusetts did. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we had Shays' Rebellion. You got this huge debt in Massachusetts. And so what does Massachusetts do? Well, they raise taxes to pay the debt. It's they raise taxes to an extremely high level, and these farmers can't pay it. So they say, well, up yours. You know, government, we're not going to do it. And so that's why they have this tax revolt called Shays Rebellion. It's a tax revolt. People don't realize that, but that's what it is. And then, you know, you got, oh my gosh, we need the Central Army to go in and crush these people because they don't want to pay their taxes. In fact, Samuel Adams is really interesting at that time period. So that these guys, Daniel Shays, should be hung because they voted for us. That's treason. No, in 1776, we didn't have representation, but now you do, so we raise taxes on you, you gotta pay them, you'll pay up. So, because Massachusetts and some other states have a huge debt, this is gonna force Virginia to pay twice. They paid their own debt off, now they gotta pay Massachusetts' debt off? I mean, give me a break. So, Patrick Henry and Henry Lee organized to resist the move by force if necessary. They call the assumption scheme unconstitutional and a violation of the compact between the states because this is not union. Not all the states are benefiting from this assumption scheme, and not all the states are being burdened equally from the assumption scheme. This is what John C. Calhoun said later on. Look, a union, everybody's got to benefit equally. Everybody's got to be burdened equally. That's what a union is all about. That's what a league of states is all about. That's what a league is. Everyone benefits. Everyone's burdened. Well, not in this case. Some people are going to be burdened excessively, and some people are going to benefit from it, like these freeloaders in Massachusetts getting off on their taxes, you know, getting off on paying their debt. Well, Madison, James Madison, of course, is in the House of Representatives, and he helps defeat the measure by a 31-29 vote. So it's pretty close, right? And so people are afraid. This, my gosh, you know, we want to do this. We really want to do this. Now, Pennsylvania pitches a compromise. They say, okay, well, look, if we're able to move the capital to a southern location, will you agree to the assumption? Well, that compromise narrowly passes, but the bitterness remains. People are generally afraid at this point. This is what's coming. Patrick Henry is saying, see, I told you so. You get this thing, we're in trouble. The other opponents of the Constitution are saying the exact same thing. See, we told you so. This is what's coming down the pike. You're going to believe Alexander Hamilton, the great used car salesman of American history? This is what you're going to get. In fact, Patrick Henry issues something called the Virginia Resolves of December 1790. He said that the assumption scheme was no more than a promotion of a moneyed and commercial interest at the expense of the agricultural and agrarian order. Now, that's Jeffersonianism, word for word. Now, Henry, interestingly enough, hated Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. So he refused eventually to side with them. You know, when Jefferson and Madison are trying to forge form their new Democratic Republican Party, Henry said, forget it. I'm going to the Federalists because I can't stand you guys. He was also worried about the French Revolution at that point, the impact that could have for the future of the world. But Henry didn't like Jefferson and Madison, so he wasn't going to join a party with them. But he basically is outlining agrarianism here. He's saying, you know, this is all for the money and interest out there. This is bad news. This is state capitalism, and we don't need it. He also said this destroyed Republican government because, you know, you're getting a plutocracy now. And this is his quote, there was no clause in the Constitution authorizing Congress to assume the debts of the states, and he's right. There's nothing in the Constitution that says they can do that. So why in the heck are we doing it? No one can answer that question. Hamilton wrote famously in a private letter, this is the first symptom of a spirit which must either be killed or will kill the Constitution. Abraham Lincoln probably thought that too. This is a symptom of a spirit that must either be killed or will kill the Constitution. Or maybe it's Hamilton that's going to kill the Constitution. Hamilton, you know, Patrick Henry is saying Hamilton's going to kill it. I think Hamilton already did kill it. He killed it in 1790. First salvo off the bat, he already killed the Constitution. Then along comes 1791. And we get the big granddaddy of the problems of the Hamiltonian regime, or the Hamilton regime in the Treasury Department, and that's creation of the National Bank. Now, of course, Bank of England was the most powerful bank in the world at that point, and Hamilton admired it. Of course, so did Robert Morris, who was getting all his ideas from. So Hamilton floats a plan to organize a Bank of the United States. And this is the brainchild of the Pennsylvania financiers, people like Robert Morris and others. And both a bank and government-created corporations had been rejected in the Philadelphia Convention when they were proposed by this Pennsylvania delegation. So what Hamilton is doing here is dusting off something that Robert Morris And the Philadelphia delegation wanted in 1787, when they were writing the Constitution, they were told, no, we can't charter a corporation. There are no government corporations. That's unconstitutional. And there's no bank. That's unconstitutional. Right. Hamilton says, I'll forget about that. We need it anyway. So he proposes a Bank of the United States, a national banking system. Well, as per the Constitution, the cabinet members can offer their opinions on such issues. And so George Washington goes to his cabinet and says, look, Jefferson, I know that you're not really for this thing, so write up an opinion saying, well, the bank is unconstitutional, let me read it. So Jefferson does. He offers an opinion. Jefferson simply says, well, look, the bank is unconstitutional because it's not in one of the enumerated powers of Article 1, Section 8. I have looked in that section of the Constitution. Can't find it. He also used the language of the 10th Amendment, which was not yet ratified, to strike a blow at the bank. And he said, well, look, if the powers aren't delegated to the government, you can't do them. This is often called the strict construction doctrine. But Jefferson is making the same point proponents of the Constitution, such as James Wilson and Hamilton himself, had made in the months before ratification. They were saying the exact same thing. Well, if it doesn't say we can do it, we can't do it. Don't worry. Don't worry, wayward sons. There is no problem here. We're going to abide by this Constitution. Trust us. Unfortunately, they didn't, and Jefferson was calling them on it. So strict construction, he's just pointing out the nature of the compact. And, of course, calling it a compact today, well, that's just evil. You can't call the Constitution a compact. It's no such thing. Why? Because the nationalists won. But it is a compact. I mean, it very simply says that in the Constitution itself. So Jefferson's just pointing this out. He's saying, well, look, it's unconstitutional. In fact, Washington's persuaded by it. He says, oh, well, sounds like you're on the right path, Jefferson. I think you're right. So he actually instructs James Madison to write his veto message because he's going to veto the legislation. And then Washington will go to Hamilton and say, look, Hamilton, you've got one day to write something up to persuade me that Jefferson's wrong. And if you can do that, then I'll side with you. So Hamilton's response sets the stage for the so-called loose constructionist position on the Constitution. And as you move forward, basically Hamilton is the brainchild of this, and then it follows, you know, then John Marshall just takes Alexander Hamilton's language and codifies that in the Supreme Court, and then Daniel Webster takes John Marshall's language, also Hamilton's language, and then, of course, Abraham Lincoln takes Webster's, Marshall's, and Hamilton's language, and echoes those words in American history, and then you have the progressives doing the exact same thing, and all the way up to Barack Obama. So this is how it starts. Hamilton wrecked the Constitution. So this is the spirit that will kill the Constitution. You know, or he must be killed, or he killed the Constitution. No, Hamilton, you're the one that's killing the Constitution, and very clearly, that's what Jefferson was saying. He said, well, yeah, sure, the bank is not specifically spelled out in the enumerated powers. Yeah, Jefferson, you're right, but read between the lines. You know, if you read between the lines, you'll find it. Because it's an implied power. We have that thing called the Necessary and Proper Clause. Yeah. That thing in Article 1, Section 8, last clause. The Necessary and Proper Clause. Yeah, the thing that Patrick Henry called the Sweeping Clause. Oops. Oh yeah, that thing. That means we can do this. Didn't matter. Wasn't enumerated. Doesn't matter, because it's implied. Read between the lines, Jefferson. Jefferson said, well, I did. There's only blank space between the lines. I haven't found anything in the Constitution that says you can do this. And this is actually what Hamilton wrote. He said, if the end be clearly comprehended within any of the specified powers, and if the measure have an obvious relation to that end, and is not forbidden by any particular provision of the Constitution, it may safely be deemed to come within the compass of the national authority. Basically, what he's saying there in 21st century American, if the ends justify the means, we can do it. That's what Hamilton said in McCulloch v. Maryland in 1819, which Dr. Gutzman will very carefully go over in later presentation. Wow! That's great! So, the Necessary and Proper Clause becomes, you can do the anything you want to do clause, as it was said later in the 20th century. This is the you can do anything you want clause, right? Because we can say, well, you know, we got to have a bank, and so we'll find something in the Constitution that means that. I mean, you know, we got to have national health care. You know, we got to have Social Security. And we got to have public health. And, you know, we got to have roads, obviously. I mean, if it wasn't for the government building roads, nobody would build a dang road. I mean, the government builds everything. They are the ones that make commerce work, by God. And if you can't, if the ends justify the means, you can do it all. I mean, there it is. There's Alexander Hamilton saying so. He's a founding father. My gosh. I mean, you say the founding fathers were against this stuff. Well, there is Alexander Hamilton himself, a founding father, saying you can do it. And then there's John Marshall, another founding father, saying you can do this. My gosh. You crazy libertarians, you crazy paleo conservatives, you guys are just all full of marbles. You know, you guys are crazy. Your brains are full of mush. You're just being, you know, persuaded by these radicals like Woods and Gutzman and McClanahan and all the, and Ron Paul, you Paulites, you Paul bots. Judge Napolitano. I mean, these people are crazy. Obviously, here it is. Hamilton. Founding fathers said this. There's a founding father right here. Mm-hmm. Well, this was never conclusively proved, you know, and of course, the bank is then Washington sides with Hamilton. He says, okay, you know, Hamilton, you know, you've persuaded me, and you're the Secretary of Treasury, so, you know, I'll side with you on this one. So Washington then sides with Hamilton, and the rest is history. Now, the bank, again, never conclusively proven that it's constitutional. McCulloch v. Maryland will supposedly establish that, but all Marshall does is dust off Hamilton. And James Madison, in signing the Second Bank of the United States in 1816, essentially all he says is, well, yeah, I mean, you know, I said it was unconstitutional, but, it's just kind of been shown as constitutional over time. Well, what does that mean? So we've got this big monstrosity central banking system in the Fed. We've had, central banking system throughout American history. Nobody's ever proven these things are constitutional. It's just because, well, you know, Hamilton said it was in 1791. And lying through his teeth. And you can show it very clearly. I mean, if people would just go back and read the ratifying debates and go read what Hamilton himself said. My gosh, he's just proving, he's exposing himself as a liar. But we don't care. Because Hamilton said it. And that's the real problem with all this stuff. Hamilton, as George Will once said, you know, we may talk about Jefferson, and we may talk about, you know, the Jeffersonian principles, but we live in Hamilton's America, and we do. The America that we have is Alexander Hamilton's brainchild, unfortunately. But, I mean, that's what it is. And it took a long time to get that process in place, but we finally got it in the 1860s, and we've never looked back. We live in Hamilton's America. Now, another big issue, 1793. So, you know, 1792, not much is going on here, but 1793... we have another big issue. It's called the Neutrality Proclamation. Now, just to give you a little background, of course, we have the French Revolution begin in 1789. And the French Revolution got pretty bloody by the 1790s. And, of course, France was at war with everybody. And, of course, they're at war with Great Britain. And in 1778, we had actually signed a treaty with them that made us perpetual allies. So now we have a real problem here. We're supposed to be perpetual allies with the French, and the French were at war with everybody. Well, that makes the United States at war with everybody. And you've got some real issues with this, because the British start being rather obnoxious, and they don't take too kindly to the United States. You know, they want the United States back anyways. And so, you know, the French don't really take too kindly to the United States, you know, trying to get out of this thing. So Hamilton, who's not even Secretary of State, but Hamilton tells Washington, well, look, we can unilaterally cancel the treaty. Don't worry about it because Louis XVI has had his head lopped off. We signed a treaty with Louis XVI. We didn't sign a treaty with the reign of, you know, the directory or, you know, the Committee of Public Safety. We didn't sign a treaty with any of those guys. You know, we signed a treaty with Louis XVI. And when they lopped his head off and they cut off Marie Antoinette's head, that was it. The treaty's canceled. So Washington, go ahead and issue a neutrality proclamation. Just say it yourself, right? Washington, you can do that. It doesn't say you can't. And if the ends justify the means, well, obviously then you can do whatever you want. Now, Jefferson is saying, no, wait a second here. We don't need to be buddied up with the French. And I agree with you because the French are going to get us into war with the British and that's going to be disastrous. But I don't see anything in the Constitution where it says the president can just unilaterally issue these proclamations like a, you know, papal bull saying this is what we're going to do. This is crazy. You can't do that. That's what a king does, and we don't have a king. So the executive, Jefferson says, does not have the authority to declare neutrality. Congress has to be part of that. These are congressional executive, you know, agreements. But Congress has to be involved in this. And James Madison thinks the same thing. So what happens is rather interesting. When Congress is not in session, Washington issues what has since been called the Neutrality Proclamation of April 1793. He didn't use the word neutral, but that's what everybody knew it meant. He also did not suspend the treaty with France. You know, Hamilton told him to suspend the treaty, just say it's canceled. But Washington knew better. He knew that if he went that far, boy, he was going to be in real trouble. So he didn't suspend the treaty with France. He does issue a proclamation, though, saying that the United States is going to, you know, not using the word neutral, but we're going to be independent, essentially. This is simply a way for the United States to avoid the dangerous situation in Europe. And I mean, everyone agreed with them. You know, yeah, we need to do this, but not everyone agreed with the method being used here. This sets a precedent, though. This makes the executive the initiator of foreign policy. So the Constitution says that the president has to have the advice and consent of the Senate when it comes to foreign policy. But now what Washington is doing is unilaterally making the executive branch the initiator of foreign policy. So it's taken a new role. So he's defining the executive here as he goes. Now, Jefferson and Madison weren't sold on the move, and both argued that because only the Congress could declare war, only the Congress could declare neutrality, which is a pretty powerful argument. The Congress can declare war, so then the Congress can declare neutrality. So they saw the move as a power grab. In fact, Congress is going to follow in 1794 with something called the Neutrality Act. What they essentially do is, through legislation, make what Washington did legal. So, but this is an unresolved issue again. I mean, here you have a power play. You know, Congress is saying one thing, the president is saying another, and everybody just eventually follows Washington's lead, and they kind of leave Congress by the wayside. But very important, this particular proclamation. Now, this doesn't even get to some of the other foreign policy issues like Jay's Treaty and, you know, how that was a foreign policy disaster, and that actually galvanizes, you know, the Jeffersonians on one side and the Hamiltonians on the other. And, you know, but there was some wonderful stuff. And of course, if you take the history survey course, you know, Dr. Gusman and I talk about some of these other issues. But, you know, constitutionally, these are some of the big issues here. So, constitutionally, could the president initiate foreign policy? Well, Jefferson and Madison said no. Washington said yes. Hamilton said yes. So here you have another split. When you look at the bank and the assumption scheme, I mean, again, these are things that the Jeffersonians are saying, no, you can't do these things. You're lying, basically. But Hamilton is saying, well, if the ends justify the means, we can do whatever we want. And that becomes a precedent that's very hard to break. So in summary, the Washington administration saw the implementation of the Constitution and was a step in defining the powers of the new government. Hamilton showed his hand and exposed his previous positions and the Federalists as lies, which laid the groundwork for the establishment of an unwritten constitution that superseded the written and ratified document of 1787 and 1788. That's the important key here. What we get, essentially, we start operating with two different constitutions. Particularly once we get case, you know, the Supreme Court involved, we get all the case law involved. So you're going to have an unwritten constitution like the British system, as opposed to the written constitution as ratified. So we essentially are playing on two different fields here, as I mentioned in another presentation. One side we're playing football, the other side we're playing baseball, and we should be playing baseball instead of football. I'm a big baseball fan. So baseball is, you know, it's a much more defined game in a lot of ways and a much slower pace. You know, football, it's a little different. So we're playing on two different fields. We need to get back to playing the same game. If you start looking at this unwritten constitution, well, yeah, you can kind of do whatever you want. If you look at the written constitution as ratified, you can't. So Jefferson and Madison are using, you know, one mode to say that legislation is unconstitutional, whereas Hamilton is not. He's using a different one. And Hamiltonianism, of course, dominates America today, as I already mentioned. Jefferson and Madison were unable to block the growth of executive power and unconstitutional legislation in the long term. They were able, perhaps at times, to put up a roadblock, and of course, in 1798, they're going to do very well with that, as Dr. Gusman will get into. But in the long term, they fail. And that's the real tragedy in all of this. In the long term, the Hamiltonians win. And that's where we sit today in the United States. So if you really want to blame anybody in American history for the mess we have, and Hamilton, of course, you know, you call him a big government guy, he wouldn't recognize the government today. It's too big. But, you know, he's the guy, he's the intellectual progenitor of all this stuff. He's putting it into effect with his opinion on the bank bill, there it is right there. I mean, everyone just kind of follows lock, stock, and barrel. You know, Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, Abraham Lincoln, you know, John Marshall, Joseph Story, they're all just regurgitating the same nonsense, the same crap that, you know, this Hamilton came up with here in 1791. So nothing's changed. And you look at Obama, I mean, this is why people were shocked. You know, you're saying the health care bill is unconstitutional. How can you say that? Of course it's constitutional, because we say it is. Right? Hamilton said, of course the bank's constitutional, because I say this, right? I've proclaimed from on high as the Secretary of Treasury that I need this, so it's constitutional. And there you have it. So, we'll pick up with some other great stuff in the next presentation. Stay tuned. Stay tuned to this Bat Channel, Bat Time, so we can get going with some more great, fun, constitutional stuff.